Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It is Tuesday, September 3rd. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. As we come off of the Labor Day holiday, we head out to the picket line. Striking hotel workers here and on the mainland are on day three of a three-day walkout. We hear more about industrial hemp. Could we do more for a green future here in Hawaii? We take a closer look at the governor's emergency housing order and, in particular, school impact fees. And we hear more about an island nation's fight for climate change and the sense of urgency for action. And September happens to be Hawaiian History Month. It started with Queen Liliuokalani's birthday celebration this weekend. Hawaii's last monarch would have been 186 years old. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We have just come off Labor Day, and here in Hawaii, strike lines are up at 8 hotels, 7 on Oahu and 1 on Kauai. We were in Waikiki yesterday, where strike lines were in full view along Kalakaua Avenue. The Kioia properties include the Moana Surf Rider Hotel and the Sheraton Princess Kaiulani Hotel. And they are workers rallied to draw attention to their labor dispute. The three-day strike is being staged by some 5,000 workers here, members of Local 5 Unite here. The union is staging the strike against hotel chains Hilton, Hyatt, and Marriott in cities across the country. Ken Velasquez has been with the Moana Surf Rider for 17 years. He works as a steward and says it's difficult to make ends meet here in Hawaii.
It's expensive here living in Hawaii, and everything's going up. And for this past 2 years, we had like two inflation that happened, and it's just too expensive here in Hawaii. So I'm walking down the line because I do believe that we, in this wages, that we really need this and we deserve it as a hard working union workers at the hotels.
How hard was it for you folks during COVID?
It was tough. It was really tough for me. There were times that I didn't know if I would have a roof over our heads during those times with my ex, and if it weren't for some help, we would have been out of the streets.
Things haven't quite come back to normal, but I understand that they haven't hired back all the employees.
There are some workers that I haven't seen come back, and I think some of them probably already moved on, but majority of the work has been cut out, and they're just giving us more workload and giving us a lot of stuff to do. And that's one of the reasons why I'm on the line, because we work hard. We're hardworking people here in Hawaii, and we do want to stay here and serve our guests the standards, good quality service that they deserve.
Another worker, Lauren Reyes, is a server at one of the Marriott hotels. She says the hotel cut room service during the pandemic and has never reinstated it.
I've been here 6 years, and I've been with Marriott for 10 years.
And so why are you walking the line today?
You know, we really need a wage increase. When we came back with our contract, they actually gave us less than what we were asking for in 2018. So, you know, we need that wage increase. We need better benefits. Our workload is a little way too much. So what we need is more staff, and, you know, they just really need to respect us and our work so we can do better for our guests. We are pinching on the staff. Like, we are taking way too many guests. And it's really hard for us to keep up and give good service because they don't have enough staff on.
What's it been like? I mean, I know that there was a recent strike against one of the Marriott's, and then there was a really big strike back in the 1990s when all the hotels walked the line. So how are you seeing, you know, this particular strike?
I think we are coming really strong in numbers, and we're getting a lot of support from even visitors. So I think it's going to be good for us, and I think the hotel sees how strong we are. And I'm so glad to be out here supporting the rest of my staff and all the other hotels too that are going through the same things as us. Because when we went and sat down and we were all discussing together like what each of these properties are going through, it's very similar stories that we're not being taken care of by management.
We also found a member of the Hawaii Nurses Union on the line over this past weekend. Nurses at Kapi'olani Medical Center for Women and Children just voted to go on strike if management doesn't come back with a better offer. George Cabillo works as an intensive care unit nurse at Queens Medical Center, which is hoping for a better contract during a time when there is a nursing shortage. He says he's been a nurse for more than 40 years and says he is well paid, which he says is not the case with hotel workers.
I'm here to support these guys because they supported us. And I know what they're striking for. I know what we're striking for. They lost a lot of money because of COVID. The owner who owns these hotels, he got all this money from the government to pay them. He didn't give them a single cent. He kept it all for himself.
And so where are you at with your contract?
It's about patient ratios, as is Kapi'olani. I can't take care of four critical care patients on ventilators by myself, but they want us to, and one of them is going to die. And they have been doing this. And they say, well, I can't afford. You just bought two hospitals in the last 2 months. You can afford to pay to bring in nurses here. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
Visitors we talked to say they did not appreciate hearing bullhorns at 4 a.m. in the morning, and they say they have not had their rooms cleaned since Saturday. The strike lines are expected to go down at midnight tonight. Local 5 Unite Here says it hopes the walkout will prompt hoteliers to come to the table with proposals more in line with their demands. No word yet of any movement. You know, the state formed a hemp task force back in May to better understand the local hemp industry. They were also looking at recommendations to promote the industry here in Hawaii. HPR's Mark Liddell joins us this morning to talk about this. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Catherine.
Now, you have been monitoring these meetings for the last month. And, you know, I recall doing a story, oh gosh, a couple of years ago when they had the very first test plot for hemp. And you took a visit to another one recently.
Yeah, that's right. And so the task force just finished up, and they have a bunch of these recommendations. I won't go into them too much. There's a lot of them that go into funding and sort of just support for local farmers. But yeah, I went out to Whitmore Village. There is a farm out there operated by this company called Ohana Hui Ventures. And they're growing hemp there to sort of test out a variety that hopefully can grow well in Hawaii, because they're sort of trying to do this proof of concept to make sure that they can grow hemp here in the state. You know, the reason to do that is because there's a lot of potential for hemp in Hawaii. There aren't a lot of folks who grow hemp for fiber, for industrial purposes, so for building materials and things like that. But hopefully the growing of hemp at this site proves that, you know, hemp can grow here, and it's something that we can do in Hawaii. I spoke with Ohana Hui Venture CEO Scotty Wong, who is at the Whitmore Village. That's his farm. And he has that test plot out there. And he said, yeah, ultimately he's hoping to export the hemp seeds.
This is approximately 1.9 acres, almost 2 acres. Of industrial hemp of a Yuma variety that specifically was made for this farm, this plot for Hawaii, from our partners in China, which is Kanda Hemp Company. And the goal is that for me here in Hawaii, what I'd like to do is to be able to grow industrial hemp seeds. And we can harvest the seeds with our partners out of Kanda Hemp and be able to export these seeds as an export crop out of Hawaii to the world.
Interesting. So it's kind of like corn seed, only hemp seed.
Yeah. And not only is it an export, or that's not the only thought for its use here, but it can be used in Hawaii. There's already a lot of interest to use it in Hawaii. I think Pacific Biodiesel says it wants to use hemp for biodiesel. A lot of folks, a lot of farmers can also use it. It's great at remediating soil, so it's a rotational crop, and so it can be useful in that way. Here's Scotty Wong again. He was talking about some of the other ways it can be used in Hawaii.
For our industrial hemp business here in Hawaii, we're hoping to be able to, you know, sell the seeds locally here to farmers that want to do hemp fiber grows in Hawaii, whether it's growing hemp for hempcrete, growing hemp for hemp plastic, maybe hemp wood, maybe for bedding, hemp bedding. And there's also another low-hanging fruit is hemp biodiesel or hemp ethanol. So these are markets that are low-hanging fruit to us that these seeds can be used for.
So I also wanted to play a bite from Scotty Race Moniz, who is the executive director for Friends of Waimanalo. That's the nonprofit arm of Ohana Hui Ventures. He says that hemp could be, there's a lot of potential here because of Hawaii's really great farming weather.
We know that it can grow anywhere, right? It's the wheat. But the best place is we're told, is in the fertile ground that we're in, and then in the sun belt temperature that we're in. We in Hawaii and everyone along this equator line that where we are, we can grow four times a year. Most of the U.S. is only one time a year because of the fall and winter.
So, and you know, you can't talk about hemp without, you know, talking about the cannabinoid side. There's all of this potential again in the fiber hemp, but nobody's actually growing it right now because there aren't. They need these machines called decortitators, which they separate the parts of
the plant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, parts of the hemp, and without those in the state, there's not really anything to anyone to sell the hemp to. So there aren't a lot of folks who are growing it. For that reason, there are cannabinoid hemp farmers, which there's been a lot of reporting about.
Right, and, medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, I feel like every year in the state legislature, there's always something going on there. And I think especially, you know, that happened this year too, with legalizing marijuana. But, you know, I thought it was interesting that there are two, it's probably more, but there are these different sides of hemp. You know, when I was talking to Scotty Wong, he said that he doesn't work a lot with the cannabinoid side because there are so many regulations with that side. But yeah, it's just interesting to see that side and you know, follow it.
But this obviously focuses industrial, and we'll have to wait to see what the lawmakers do with the recommendations.
Yeah, we
but
do.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks, Adam.
We've been talking to Mark Liddell, and you know what? We are going to have to take a pause for the emergency broadcast alert. Stay with us.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
September is Classical Music Month, and HPR2 is celebrating with a top 100 list of your favorite compositions. Tell us your favorites, and you'll be entered into our drawing for Hawaii Symphony Orchestra tickets or our new HPR2 day bag. Tune in to HPR2, September 18th through the 27th, to find out if your favorites made the list. Submit your picks by this Friday. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/classicalmonth.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Pacific Health, committed to helping create a healthy Hawaii with preventive care and with a dedication to a personalized approach. Learn more at hawaiipacifichealth.org/healthierlife.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukauai, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhavai.
As we kick off Hawaiian History Month, we're delving into the musical archives for a fun slack key guitar backyard quiz. Today's mystery musician learned directly from the students of the Paniolos, the original Kiʻōalu players. Growing up, she played music for Queen Liliʻuokalani in the years after the overthrow, and her style of slack key is described as simple and adorned and is one of the oldest ever documented. She's even considered to be the first woman to play the Hawaiian steel guitar. By teaching Hawaiian music from the 1940s to the Hawaiian Renaissance of the 70s, she kept the art alive. But her skills don't stop there. She is recognized as a kumuhula, a laymaker, and native speaker of the Hawaiian language. Today, she is recognized as one of the most celebrated female Hawaiian musicians ever. But who is she? Hint, she celebrated her 132nd birthday last month. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right wins a reusable HPR tote bag.
For the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NāreitHawaii.com.
Housing, housing, housing. That's what Governor Josh Green's emergency order aims to expedite, not just for Maui, but across the state. Here to talk about that is HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning.
Yes, yeah, so usually when, you know, developers try and get projects through, there are a list of conditions they have to comply with. And under this order, they get a pass, right, on some of these things. They get waivers.
Right, yeah. It's been over a year since Governor Josh Green issued his emergency proclamation on affordable housing, and that was his effort to address the state's housing crisis. And in that, he gave the ability to exempt a couple of different building codes or building stipulations that developers normally have to go through. So 9 affordable housing projects have received building exemptions through the governor's emergency proclamation, totaling 4,500 units on Oahu, Kauai, and Maui. So originally, this was kind of a controversial move that Governor Green did. And there's a group called the Build Beyond Barriers Working Group, which was made up of stakeholders. And they were supposed to be making the decisions on what developments get these exemptions. And during that time, only one project got approved by them before the powers of that working group were then moved to the Hawaii Housing Finance and Development Corporation. So that director is the one that makes all the decisions on what developments get these building exemptions through the emergency proclamation. And so only one project has actually been denied. And that was the one out in Kihei. But the reason for that was because they're trying to target new developments that are kind of in the earlier phases. And they said that this one was well on its way. So that's the reason they declined it. But the biggest project that got one of these exemptions is the Hawaii Public Housing Authority's Mira Right Redevelopment Project, which is over 2,000 residential units. And it will not have to go before the city council for approval and will be able to just get approved by DPP Director Don Takichiapuna. And then the next largest is Kahuina Kaka'ako Block C, which is being developed by Stanford Carr. And that's a mixture of rental and for sale units, totaling over 800, and it was exempted from the school impact fee. And in fact, 6 out of the 9 projects that got exemptions through the emergency proclamation were for the school impact fee.
And the school impact fee, I mean, that's basically putting money into a fund so that they can build new schools with the idea that, you know, if there's increased density and families move in, they've got to go to school somewhere.
That's exactly right. And so it was levied on residential units in four areas that were expected to have large population growth due to increased development. So that was Ala Moana to Kalihi, Leeward Oahu, West Maui, and Central Maui. And like you said, the idea is as the increased housing stock would then create an influx of children in those areas that could overwhelm public schools. So developers building in those areas need to pay the Department of Education a school impact fee before getting their building permit. So depending on the area and type of residence, it can cost between $2,000 and $5,000 per unit, not just big high-rises, but also single-family homes or ADUs as well. And then the collected fees go into a fund that would be used to build new schools. But Sherry Nakamura, Policy and Program Officer at the Hawaii School Facilities Authority, which took over administrating the School Impact Fee Fund in June from the DOE, said it's been tricky to spend it.
None of it has been spent up until this day. It costs probably maybe $200 million to build a new school or more, and it is a very small contribution. So the question is whether or not that benefit of added funds, is that going to be worth the cost of administering the program? In addition to that, it's a burden on the residents who are going to live in this area. Even though theoretically, right, the idea is it's going to be fair and equitable because these people are going to be coming into the area and they're going to be using the facility. But the reality of today's Hawaii is it's very expensive to live anywhere. And is the benefit worth the cost?
And there's only one person at the School Facilities Authority that now processes all of the state school impact fees. And Nakamura was also concerned about another looming deadline, which is the school impact fees have a 20-year time limit on them. So that means starting in 2031, if it's not spent, the funds will need to start being returned to those who paid it because DOE started collecting those funds back in 2011.
Wow. Yeah. So how much is in that fund now?
$18 million. And all of it has been unspent. The Department of Education did not respond to questions about its past management of the funds. But a 2019 state audit found that there were many issues with the program, which included the lack of proper methodology that the DOE would be using to select what areas the school impact fees would apply to. And, you know, we kind of see across the board declining rates of people going to public school than DOE. And so with a quick glance of some numbers, which is not a one-to-one comparison because the Department of Education complex areas don't run exactly with the areas that are school impact fee districts. But, you know, the number of enrolled students in public school in the Kaimuki McKinley Roosevelt area, where Kaka'ako Ala Moana area residents would be sending their children, since 2018, there's been almost a 2,000 decline in enrollment. And of those, you know, from what I could tell from the complex areas, only Kapolei was growing in population of children going to public school.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion at the Hawaii Development Authority about the Kaka'ako district. You know, they had proposed that Pohukaina. I think Governor Neil Abercrombie was wanting to build the tallest high-rise there, and they would include, you know, a modern school in the building. But yeah, I don't know that the number of students have actually materialized. You know, the enrollments are dropping.
Right. And I think that that's why we're seeing there's been some movement within the legislature to either adjust or scrap the school impact fees. Representative Luke Evslin, he chairs the House Housing Committee, introduced a measure last legislative session that would have excluded all housing projects that were for those making 140% AMI or lower and additional dwelling units exempt from school impact fees. Originally, the bill was going to scrap the program entirely, but they watered it down a bit to see if they could get it passed. However, the Senate would not schedule it for a hearing, so it died. Here's Representative Evslin.
When it's already so hard to build housing, we shouldn't be adding new barriers to housing. And I think that it's important to be funding new school construction, but I think all taxpayers should bear that burden and not just essentially new homeowners. So I personally don't like the school impact fee, even if it were getting used. And then the fact that it's not getting used, I think, makes it even more clear that we need to repeal it.
And I also spoke with Senator Stanley Chang, who is the Senate housing chair, and he also wanted to see the school impact fee addressed.
One of the main reasons why housing is so expensive in Hawaii is that there are so many fees and permits and bureaucratic processes that a home builder has to go through before being able to open that home for sale or for rent. And the school impact fee is just one of them. It's not the only one, but if we're going to be serious about reducing prices for new construction for housing here in Hawaii, then the school impact fee is going to be one of those fees that we're going to have to peel back.
Yeah, I mean, it sounded probably like a good idea at the time, but it's not, you know, bearing out to be very practical, I guess.
Right, right. And I think that those who want to get rid of these fees are hoping that the momentum from the emergency proclamation will kind of help get some legislation passed next session. Although I think Evelyn hoped that it would be pushed forward by the School Facilities Authority or the governor himself. But I'm also interested if you're a builder or developer working on affordable housing or just trying to build a single-family home or an ADU. I'm trying to hear from people who are going through that process and what some of the barriers are there. So please reach out if you have anything you want to add.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Ashley.
Thanks.
We've been talking to HPR's Ashley Mizuo. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres made international headlines this past week, calling for big polluters to take responsibility to reduce their emissions because they are putting the world at risk. Pacific Islands are among the most vulnerable, and it underscores a case before the International Court of Justice that will be heard later this year. Julian Uggen is a writer, but he's also an attorney, and his firm Blue Law Ocean is representing the island nation of Vanuatu in this case. He is here in the islands to give a talk as part of the University of Hawaii Better Tomorrow series taking place tomorrow evening. He dropped by our studios this morning.
The UN Secretary General's amazing on climate. So he was just at the Leaders Forum in Pith in Tonga. So he was sort of just echoing what so many of our Pacific leaders already know and what we have been sort of saying on the sort of world stage for such a long time, that is that the climate crisis is not only sort of at our doorstep, but it's banging down the door. For sure, Pacific communities, I mean, communities across Oceania are considered frontline communities when it comes to the climate crisis, meaning that we're already feeling a wide range of adverse effects in real time right now. So there's absolutely urgency. You know, we basically have a decade to get it right. We have a decade left. This is the most important decade, arguably, in human history.
And then you were representing Vanuatu before the UN. Talk about that case.
Yes. My firm, Blue Ocean Law, is representing Vanuatu now in the present sort of advisory proceedings that are underway at the Peace Palace in The Hague. So basically, the UN's principal judicial organ is the International Court of Justice. So this is the ICJ or the World Court. And it sits in The Hague. And so we are now arguing our case. You know, this case is an advisory opinion on climate change. And it concerns both the legal obligations of all countries with concern to climate change, as well as the legal consequences for the breach of those obligations. So we are really asking the court to clarify, you know, what are the true extent, you know, of the obligations of all countries to avert climate catastrophe.
What made you decide to take on this case and argue it in international court?
Oh, I'm very fortunate, you know, that, you know, we have the trust of the Vanuatu government. Because, you know, this case has been going on in some ways for 5 years, because essentially to ask the world court an opinion like this, you need a simple majority of 193 UN member states. So we're talking about like at least 97 countries, you know, so we had to rally a sort of global coalition in effect.
So intense lobbying.
Well, the government on its part. In our part, as legal team, our one and only job was to defend the integrity of the legal question being asked of the court. So we want essentially to help Vanuatu help the rest of the world break out of the sort of quagmire that we're in. In some ways, the international climate change regime has suffered from one thing, like legal ambiguity surrounding the extent or the scope of the obligations of all countries to, you know, avert climate, you know, change and the worst effects of climate change. And so what we're asking the court to do is to bring to bear on the question of climate change the full panoply of international legal rules. We're trying to change the world, essentially, especially for the benefit of the most vulnerable.
And then you plan to go argue this in December?
Yes, the oral proceedings in this case begin on December 2nd. In The Hague. And so we will be there along with possibly up to 91 other countries and international organizations.
So this could be a real game changer.
It really could be, truly. This could unlock finally the power of international law to help all countries on Earth basically do what the climate crisis really requires, which is drastic transformations of how we live our lives.
And we just hosted FESPAC. Mm-hmm. And to hear the conversations that were going on, just because there is this need to do something quickly.
You know?
I mean, it was just a good way to connect with everybody again.
For sure. I think that was one of the sort of better things about FESPAC. I was here. There was some events that I loved. And of course, I always am a fan of like sharing of culture and also the beauty, just the beauty of everything from the visual art to the tattooing. But I really, really appreciated the conversations about the climate crisis, because a lot of indigenous Pacific communities, we have part of the solution, you know, and part of the solution to the climate crisis is actually returning to sort of indigenous values about stewardship, about care for the land, care for the ocean, you know, caretaking cultures. You know, indigenous peoples all over the world, we are the sort of greatest and closest sort of custodians, right? Of this sort of natural world. And so that's what we sort of all recognize in common. And now it's time to really act. And it's time to force our governments to act accordingly.
Well, you know, full disclosure, I'm from Guam, you're from Guam. And I was able to go back home this summer. And just seeing it again, we have so much to lose. The beauty and the environment. And I guess that's what struck me, you know, going back this trip this summer.
For sure. I mean, you know, I think that's really important. I think it's time to interrupt the dominant conversation about climate change, because it's not only about the sort of the stakes being high. It's not only about the loss, you know, but it's and the urgency. It's all of those things, but it's more than that. It's also about wrapping our arms around the earth and around each other, around our particular corners of the earth as we know them, as we love them. And Guam, you know, our home, is impossibly beautiful in some ways. And so it's really time to try to provide maximal legal protection for all of that, including our more than human relatives.
And you wrote a book, No Home for Eight-Spotted Butterflies. And when I was there, I was just so delighted and enchanted with the millions of butterflies that I saw when I was there. You also wrote a piece, To Hell with Drowning, which was so eloquently written, but I think it just drives home the need to take care of where we live.
For sure, for sure. And part of what I'm trying to argue in that piece, I don't know if it's so explicit, but at least implicitly, is, you know, when it comes to climate change, we have been kind of more or less inundated with facts. We have facts for days, you know, and they haven't changed our behavior. They haven't moved us, not they haven't really compelled us to do what needs to be done. And I believe that that's what's missing now. It's a new level of intimacy when we talk about the climate change, when we talk about the climate crisis. And the way to do that is not necessarily by facts, but by stories. You know, maybe science in the end won't save us, but stories will.
And it's that connection, whether it's whether you have relatives in a cemetery on the coast that are, you know, at risk of falling into the sea, you know, or something else.
Sure. I mean, one of the communities that we sort of interviewed, we gathered stories, you know, from across Oceania. And one of them that was so moving to me was this a community in Veribari. It's a village that sort of is situated at the mouth of a river in the Gulf province of Papua New Guinea. And then this one community has already moved four times due to sea level rise. This will be their fifth and final climate-induced relocation. And the reason why it's final is because there's no more inland to go. So, you know, the stakes could not be higher. But, you know, when storm surges happen, you know, these waves are sort of crashing into the poles that keep these people's homes erect and standing. And, you know, so what we've heard stories about are entire communities, inclusive of children, diving in the dead of night during king tides to save, you know, save their homes from debris, slamming into the poles that keep their homes up. That level of devotion, I mean, it says so much. These people are fighting for more than their physical homes, but also to stave off a certain kind of spiritual deprivation. So we are fighting for them and their right to live in the world on their own terms.
You know, during FESPAC, I was struck by the speeches at the opening parade, opening session, and talking about we are not people from tiny islands, we are caretakers of the world's largest ocean. Mm-hmm. And that was just like, wow.
Yeah, it's a powerful reframing, you know? It's taking back our space and our time, you know, and I think a lot of leaders did that. Marshall Islands and as well as a few other islands really made really powerful opening statements. And some of those statements were political. They're like, it's time to act with the sort of urgency, right, that the climate crisis requires.
And so what's your story? What propelled you growing up to go down this path?
Oh, that's a great question. More difficult. I think I would start with the fact that, you know, when I was young and my father died when I was 9 years old and I lived in a really sort of arguably secluded area. It's Mount Santa Rosa. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
Very, very, very north on Guam. And so it's really sort of empty. The population is really tiny. So I didn't really have a lot of playmates as a kid, you know, and I was sort of alone on a red dirt mountain. And I sort of, my first experiments with empathy were really from mollusks, you know, from a family of tree snails. I would watch them, you know, I write that that in the book No Country for Eight-Spot Butterflies that you talked about, and I really sort of like watched them move so slowly and sort of wondered if they could ever move swiftly enough to save their own lives. And sort of that experience, that loneliness, sort of like that particular period of my life, I think made me identify with really the most vulnerable. And I think in some ways as a lawyer, I've tried to operationalize that same idea. I think as a law firm, Blue Ocean Law is really invested in the work of what I would call radical listening. Radical listening to me is listening to the voices of those who are most vulnerable, those whose lives are more precarious than our own, and amplifying those voices. I think that's really what we're really doing. We are working with Vanuatu, the Melanesian Spearhead Group, and the Organization of African, Caribbean, and Pacific States. These are essentially are the sort of most climate vulnerable communities on the face of the earth, and we're sort of making really sort of important arguments about the future and our children's right and our children's children's right to inherit the earth.
So you will be here through the semester up at the University of Hawaii?
Yes. I have the honor of serving as the Fall 2024 Dan and Maggie Inouye Distinguished Chair in Democratic Ideals. So I will be teaching a course at the law school.
And then following that, you'll be headed to argue in the international court.
Yes, at the ICJ in the first week of December, I will be leaving to The Hague.
That was Julian Ogun, radical listener, environmental attorney, and writer, who will give a talk at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow at the University of Hawaii as part of the Better Tomorrow speaker series. He will also take part in the Hawaii Book and Music Festival this month. We will have links to tomorrow's event on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Tune to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, streaming and more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaii Book and Music Festival live at UH Manoa September 14th and 15th with a new panel discussion, AI Impact on the Humanities. Schedule at hawaiibookandmusicfestival.com.
Inflation may have slowed, but not everyone's happy with the economy.
If you're a person who's trying to buy a home still, you're not looking at, well, things are a little better than they were 2 months ago. You're looking at, gosh, they're a lot worse than they were 3 years ago.
The On Point Money Ladies are back to talk inflation, housing, and COVID's lasting effects on the economy. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
And now let's corral your attention back to our backyard quiz. Earlier, we shared a few details about today's mystery musician who grew up decades after slack key was introduced to the islands by Mexican vaqueros. She was born after the overthrow and recalled playing music for Queen Liliuokalani as a teenager. As a well-known composer and a teacher, she was a key figure of the Hawaiian Renaissance of the 1970s. In 1974, she was featured on PBS Hawaii's Pauhana Years program, a show targeted towards senior citizens. On the show, she promoted her first and only album, which she released at the age of 82. Some of the songs on that album include Kaumanu and Paniolo Slack Key. And if you haven't guessed it yet, this musician is Auntie Alice Namakilua, whose birthday was August 12th. And congrats, Rich Nakata from Honolulu, you got it right. That is the answer to today's quiz. If you have an idea for one to share, write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you support HPR, you support storytelling that illuminates understanding.
Our obligation was to each other, and the unwritten rule was this: we all come back or nobody comes back.
My son was in the Air Force, and he's a wounded warrior. He was severely injured in Afghanistan at just the precious age of his early 20s.
We hear stories that remind us of our humanity.
This was something that happened, as they say, a normal reaction to abnormal circumstances.
My service in combat, my service in Vietnam, probably is the singular most event or experience that I had that put me on a path to where I am today.
Help HPR uplift more community voices. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
September marks Hawaiian History Month, and it kicked off this weekend with a number of events marking the 186th anniversary of the birthday of Hawaii's last monarch. HPR was there at the Cathedral of St. Andrews yesterday for a celebration that culminated in a march to Iolani Palace to share hula and mele and ole to honor Queen Liliuokalani on her birthday, September 2nd. Ke kuku ila maia ke onene. And there was also a reenactment on palace grounds around the Queen's women behind the Kuei petition, a collection of signatures of the Queen's loyalists who opposed the overthrow and urged that the Queen be reinstated. We talked to Meliana Meyer, who helped to organize the events at St. Andrew's Church.
You know, we make offerings, we march in or walk in Liliu's footsteps to be reminded of the work we still need to do. And we remember her on her Laha now, which is September 2nd every year. We've turned her observance of just birthday, which is wonderful as a celebration, into the hard work of getting educated, finding out what our stories are, what the truth is, and how we as Pō'e Hawaii, all of us, not just Hawaiians or Kanaka, but all of us who live here as Kavika Merzberg, who did beautiful hula with his halau today, we come here to honor Liliʻu, and we come here to honor truth and education. We're all educators. We want people to know the truth about Hawaii, Hawaii's past, and we're resigned to affirm, not resigned, but to affirm the work that she continues to do through us, because my aunt Aima Nawahi and Joseph Nawahi, they were patriots, as I am as well, and I think the DNA speaks loudly for a lot of us and those who want to be part of being on the side of truth. Witnessing every year, we've continued, we began this whole process of celebrating Liliʻu's birthday as far back as 2006. So we do now theatrical reenactments, we bring choirs together, we have services, we honor by making pu'olo and lei for each other and for those we support, just to educate one another and educate malihini, those who are coming for the first time. All of this is really important, you know, as legacy is and as history is. And you know that 1898 was also a very profound time, not just 1893 or when Liliʻu was born in September, on the 2nd of September, 1838, I believe. But today, in 2024, we have the work to do to continue to restore the kingdom, the nation, and it isn't to go back so much as it is to see in the future what we can bring of Hawaiian values to really support that notion of Hawaiian soul, bringing all of these things back to pono, to balance.
And there are a number of events, you know, this month kicked off with the concert with some of her music. And we have a number of, I guess, symposiums or gatherings around the 1898 conversation. But there are many other things that are happening because it is Hawaiian History Month.
And it graduated from a one-day event to a multiple, you know, month-long event of history, of medicine, of historical or theater, of musical compositions. So we took over the month just to say, hey, we've got so much to share, and we're all earnest and sincere in our own forms, whether it's scholastic or artistic or, you know, all of the above. We have our student films going on today, which is really important. Six young ones are showcasing their films, and we will be showcasing their work at the judiciary at the end of the month, because those are our up-and-coming filmmakers. So we're really trying to support the youth in finding their purpose and finding causes that are pono for Hawaii and for the world. Justice and truth really needs to prevail.
So we teach them history, and we hope they take that and run with it to help guide them in the decisions that need to be made going forward.
Correct. And we have a Hawaii Punui Coalition. We have extraordinary kokua from a group of volunteers from Suli Stroud and Malia Nobriga, who does an incredible job with all of the PR. And then there's a small group of us, and we all are here just to kokua our story, our education, the mo'olelo of this place. And we're grateful to be here today. Thank you, Catherine.
That was Meliana Meyer, who helped organize some of the events to mark the Queen's birthday this weekend. There will be events over the entire month of September, including talks this week around the events of 1898, the Spanish-American War, and the political climate that was pivotal to Hawaii's history. We will have links on the conversation page of our website later today. Thank you. are out of time. That does it for us. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from a local physical therapist who is on a mission to help people alleviate lower back pain. Got feedback for us? Call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation as a podcast on our website or on Apple, Google, or Spotify. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.